Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live this June 30th, 2013, from an undisclosed location outside of Charlotte, North Carolina.
The spice expands consciousness.
Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, we're about to enter into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Boy, have we got a program for you tonight. This is the 150th year after the Gettysburg Address. We're going to cover a little bit of that tonight. So much news tonight. Normally we just have about, 35, 40 pages of content to cover. Tonight we have 54 pages. If I don't get through it all, you can write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com and I'll send you my program notes tonight. It's great stuff. This is a live program. We're going to leave the phones open all night. Our phone number here, 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. We're on channel 2 of bbsradio.com. You can also reach us by going to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com and accessing it there. We encourage you to participate in the program. Just a couple of items before we begin. Don't forget about the food investor. You never know when weather or whatever is going to leave you in the hands of FEMA. And I know you trust them to provide you cookies and cocoa and a warm blanket, but it's better if you provide for yourself. So do so. Invest in something that can really help you or help your neighbors or your family. The food investor. Click on the banner at X Squared Radio on the right-hand side. You'll see that. Solar wind is a smoking 585 kilometers per second, and there are four sunspots on the sun today. However, none of them pose a threat for flares. The western U.S. is experiencing a record-setting heat wave, with temperatures reaching 128 degrees Fahrenheit and higher. That's in the shade, by the way. A geomagnetic storm that began late on June 28th, when Earth passed through a region of south-pointing magnetism in the solar wind, is now subsiding. The storm sparked northern lights in the USA as far south as Kansas. Kansas, the birthplace of Superman. In total, observers in more than a dozen U.S. states reported visual or photographic sightings of auroras. Really cool stuff. All right, welcome to the program. By the way, if you're outside the United States, you can reach us if you can get to a cell phone tower, 530-413-9537. We also have our conference line, as it were, live tonight, so if you must get out, you can dial this on your cell phone, 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000, then the passcode 696, I'm sorry, 769-608-POUND, 769-608-POUND. Put it on speed dial or just go to x2-radio.com. If you have a Droid phone, click on the Droid app on the left-hand side of the screen, and it'll be instantaneous. You'll have the app on your phone. Lots of great content here on the BBS Radio Network. You know, more audio content than any other webcast radio network in the world. So, and you get a really broad variety, really broad variety. You not only get lots of self-help stuff and great opinion pieces, but you get great news and scientific content like right here at X Squared Radio. A story out of Wichita, Kansas. A Kansas physician, now this is interesting to see our health care landscape changing, and this is primarily brought about because health insurance is changing. Yes, they are independent of one another. I know this because I raised four kids all to adulthood and paid for health care out of my pocket. Which wasn't too bad. Some years it was $1,000, some years it was less, but I could afford health care. all the stitches and strep throat and ear infections and blah, blah, blah. Just pay for it out of your pocket. Go to the doc in a box, get your prescription, pay for the doctor, and you're on your way. And guess what? Next month, if everybody's healthy, no payments. Health insurance? Forget about it. $8,000 a year? Wasn't happening in my household. But I raised four kids and myself and did so paying for the health care out of my pocket. By the way, 85% to 90% of the country can do just that. And by the time they reach 40 or 50, they're going to be about $200,000 ahead of the game. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you could pay for a house with what you spend on insurance. And by the way, insurance is not health care. So a Kansas physician says he makes the same income and offers better quality care to his patients after he dumped all health insurance companies. Dumped them all. 32-year-old family physician Doug Nunemaker of Wichita, Kansas, said after 5 years of dealing with the red tape of health insurance companies and the high overhead for the staff he hired just to deal with the paperwork, he switched to a system of charging his patients a monthly fee plus the price of an office visit or test. For example, under Nunemaker's membership plan, I know this guy's just a doctor, but believe it or not, his plan actually works. It's known as concierge medicine or direct primary care. Each patient pays a flat monthly fee to have unlimited access to the doctors and any medical service they can provide in the practice, such as stitches or an EKG, you know, prescribing medication for a sore throat, that kind of stuff. Any lab testing that has to be done, then that's added on to it. For adults up to age 44, Nunemaker charges only $50 a month. Pediatric services are $10 a month. And for adults age 44 and older, it costs $100 a month. Although Nunemaker calls the practice cash only, he accepts credit and debit cards for the fees and services. Nunemaker and his partner negotiated deals for services outside the office, like labs. A cholesterol test costs the patient $3 versus the $90 or more billed to insurance companies. An MRI can cost $400. I've seen prices $2,500 compared to $2,000 or more billed to insurance companies. I paid $250 for my MRI when I had my motorcycle accident a year ago, last month. The practice encourages patients and families to also carry some type of high-deductible health insurance plan in case of an emergency or serious illness requiring hospitalization, which we don't like to talk about. By the way, those really high-deductible plans, and I'm talking $5,000 deductibles, are for things like cancer or diabetes or something where you have the onset of a really chronic illness that's going to cost, you know, could take your house away from you. And that kind of insurance is actually very affordable. But the kind of insurance that most people think about when they think about insurance, oh my gosh, Susie has a runny nose, quick, let's go to the doctor. We have a copay, a $10 copay. Get over it, people. You're going to have to buy your medication. $40 or $50 worth of medication is not going to kill you. It might heal you. It might make you feel a lot better, but you only got to pay it once. And then you don't have to pay $600, $700, $800, even $900 a month for insurance in those months when you're healthy. Nunemaker said his annual salary is around $200,000, and he gets to spend more time with patients providing better care because he's not watching the clock, and he gets to spend more time with his family. Now, if more physicians took the position that Nunemaker in Wichita, Kansas is taking, we wouldn't even have a need for Obamacare. By the way, recent survey just came out today, 81%. A whopping 81% of Americans believe that Obamacare will either make their health care situation worse or unknown. 81%. Not a very good sales job, I would say. Well, it appears there's a new breed of asteroid. A big asteroid that flew past Earth last month belongs to a new category of space rock, scientists say. Asteroid 1998 QE2 and its moon sailed within 3.6 million miles of Earth. Not really a threat to us this time around. New radar images captured by the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico are revealing just how unique this binary asteroid is. Asteroid QE2 is dark, red, and primitive. That is, it hasn't been heated or melted as much as other asteroids. QE2 is nothing like any asteroid we've visited with a spacecraft or plan to, or that we have meteorites from. It's an entirely new beast in the menagerie of asteroids near Earth. Proof positive that we, as Earth and our solar system, are in a new neighborhood. Up toward the galactic plane, we tend to see much older, much more primitive, and much more distant free-floating objects that will hover around the galactic plane. I often call this a gravel road in space. So look for more of the same. The 1,000-foot-wide Arecibo dish and NASA's 230-foot deep space network antenna in Goldstone, California, tracked 1998 QE2 as it approached Earth last month, then kept following the near-Earth asteroid as it receded into the depths of space. The resulting radar images have helped researchers take QE2's measure. The dark, cratered main asteroid is 1.9 miles wide and it has a 2,500-foot moon that orbits once every 33 hours or 32 hours. And it's roughly one quarter the size of the main asteroid. Kind of interesting to have something so dense that it can actually gravitationally hold a moon. Asteroid 1998 QE2 was discovered in August of 1998 by astronomers working with MIT's Lincoln Near-Earth Asteroid Research Program in New Mexico. Another interesting thing about this is that it is proof positive of what we call planetary capture or moon capture theory, where one free-floating body can actually come into orbit around another free-floating body. It happens all the time in space, and in fact, most of the planets in the Milky Way galaxy are free-floating planets. They do not revolve around stars. They are looking for some place to orbit around. That's why some of the planets in our solar system aren't from around here. NASA's Kepler spacecraft has spotted 503 new potential alien worlds, some of which may be capable of supporting life as we know it. Some of these new planet candidates are small, and some reside in the habitable zone of their stars, which means water is liquid. It's not steaming or, you know, what we call dry steam at something like 1,200 degrees, and it's not frozen like some planets are out there, but it is in the liquid zone. So a lot of work remains to be done with these results. The latest haul brings Kepler's tally of exoplanet candidates to 3,216. Just 132 of them have been confirmed by follow-up observations to date, but mission scientists expect at least 90% will end up being the real deal. Now, what does that mean? When you have a planet that's in the habitable zone, are there habitations on there? Is there actually life on there? I would say, as a biologist, that life happens. It is seeded, what do we call it, transpermia, where asteroids and comets and different kinds of space debris harboring either bacterial or algae life forms do make it into that biosphere, and those things begin to multiply and equalize, come to some sort of an ecology on that planet. And then as more life comes in and feeds off of that ecology, it rebalances and so forth. So that's how it happens. By the way, the $600 million Kepler spacecraft launched just 4 years ago, March of 2009. And it was kicking off a 3.5-year mission to determine how common Earth-like planets are throughout the Milky Way galaxy. Here we are 4 years later, and we are still getting such a stream of data from this space program that it is keeping numerous universities and inspiring numerous new teams of astronomers to lifetime careers trying to keep up with all the data. I think for my vote, it was a highly successful space program. By the way, NASA currently has 68 active space programs, just so you know. Kepler spots exoplanets by detecting the tiny brightness dips caused when they pass in front of their stars' faces from the instrument's perspective. In other words, it fixes on a star, watches it very closely, and then when a planet passes in front of it, it blocks some of the light. That dip is proportional to the size of that planet. Now, obviously, Kepler has to be in line with the plane of that solar system. If it's oblique to that solar system, guess what? Planet never passes in front of the sun. So those 3,000-some-odd exoplanets that it has observed is only a small, very small portion of the actual planets that could be out there. There could be habitable planets with occupants that Kepler flew right by, never even noticed. Why? Well, because they never passed in front of their sun. Kepler launched with four functioning reaction wheels, three for immediate use and one spare. But one wheel, known as number two, failed in July of 2012, and a second, number four, gave up the ghost last month. It robbed the spacecraft of its precision pointing ability. These wheels act as static gyroscopes. When a wheel begins turning, it assumes its own stability, sort of like your bicycle when you ride it down the street. The wheels turning create a gyroscopic effect, giving the bicycle its stability. That's why you don't fall over when you're riding it. It's the same thing inside the spacecraft. It has four wheels, high-mass wheels, that spin at fairly high RPM, 20 to 30,000 RPM. And this mass gives a resistance, an inertia, against which the spacecraft can move to aim its cameras. With two of those wheels failing, you only have two axes upon which the spacecraft can point its camera. So its ability is slowly failing. I think the warranty went out at 3.5 years, and we're now just a little over 4 years. At least one of the wheels cannot be recovered. Kepler's planet hunting days are almost certainly over, and a new mission will have to be drawn up for the spacecraft. Engineers have identified a number of tests that could help gauge the likelihood of bringing back the bulky wheels, Hunter said. They're currently developing these commands on the Kepler test bed at Ball Aerospace in Boulder, Colorado, where the spacecraft was built. It will likely be several weeks before they are ready to implement the commands on the reaction wheels aboard the spacecraft, Mr. Hunter wrote in the June 7th update. We will continue to provide updates on significant changes as these plans develop and mature. Now, this being the 150th anniversary since the Gettysburg Address brings me to this portion of the program. We've got about 40 minutes left in this hour. Excuse me while I take a sip of this heavenly orange juice. I want to make sure you know the phone lines are open, but for the next 10 or 15 minutes, I'm going to ask the studio not to answer any unrelated calls because I really want to make this point. This is very powerful stuff. As I was preparing it, it actually almost moved me to tears because it is a piece that's near and dear to my heart, and I have several colleagues out there, some of whom have contributed to this piece tonight. I will give credit when that comes. And I find that as a community, as a nation, as a national family, we find ourselves in a very uncomfortable position. We are rife with scandal. Our leadership has been emasculated, and it doesn't know it. And it puts the American people in a very peculiar position where we are unsure about the future of our nation, our investments, our own personal property. And so I titled this piece, When a Nation Needs Leadership. I want to reflect a little today in remembrance of the price we have paid as a nation to retain our republic. We've had our battles with greed and avarice. We've had our internal divisions, which is in some respect continues to this day. Leaders have attempted to unite us, but we really remember the events that culminate when those efforts are dramatically defeated by leadership that is not afraid to risk their politics to do so. Abraham Lincoln inherited a nation that was economically divided and exploited by bankers and industrialists to the point that Washington had become a liability to the republic. Although analysts have said there were many ways war could have been averted, the power of the banks proved almost too great, even for Lincoln to defeat. Those powers drew us into war, and Lincoln found himself in a position to seek the faith and support of the American people to overcome them. He won, but they killed him anyway. In order to win, the North had to first win a battle. When the war began, the North lost every single battle for almost 3 years. Gettysburg was more than a victory for the nation. It was a defeat of the bankers who tied his hands and sent hundreds of thousands of Northern soldiers to their deaths in one defeat after another, until Gettysburg. That was the first battle won by his will to unite the country behind the ideal of the constitutional right to liberty and freedom. Lincoln could not pass up this opportunity. No. Within 3 months of the victory at Gettysburg, a memorial graveyard and backdrop was constructed with a single focus, around-the-clock construction. It was done for remembrance, and it was done for one speech, one photo opportunity, as it were. And then the speech that changed the war won the faith of the voters and thus their congressmen so that funds could be raised. So great was the challenge, by the way, that Northern bankers denied Lincoln loans to finance the war. Lincoln had to create his own currency, backed by nothing but the faith and credit of the United States of America to defeat these banks. And then these 278 earth-changing words. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. These brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. We are now here again, not at Gettysburg per se, not at the brink of civil war, but we are divided between those who see us enslaved by the banks of the world and those who remember what it is like to be free. It has been so long, I doubt this generation even knows what it is like. The following facts and reports are to alert you that leadership is needed now more than ever. Leadership that is not concerned so much about the next election, but is dedicated to that proposition that is the liberty and freedom upon which this nation, in fact, this entire human race, was founded. Perhaps these 278 words need to be spoken again. Perhaps we need a leader who has the integrity and focused vision that we can recapture our republic from the force that has us, in fact, this entire civilized world, in the grips of oppression and the slavery of debt and its derivatives. Let not another day of this concerted effort by the agency government go by without thinking about this story. This was written by Douglas J. Hagman. I have edited it because I wanted to put my own thoughts in here. So it's a combination of Mr. Hagman's and my thoughts. This was written today. As detailed by well-known Erwin W. Lutzer in his book When a Nation Forgets God, an unidentified Christian pastor shared a story with him of someone living in Germany during the Nazi takeover. The person sharing the story was a church-going Christian and a member of a small church located adjacent to railroad tracks. Every Sunday morning, according to this eyewitness, the Christian congregation could hear the whistle of the train in the distance as it neared the town, the noise of the wheels over the tracks, and as the train passed, the cries coming from inside the train. The cries were those of the Jews being transported to concentration camps, a process that occurred with regularity each Sunday morning during their worship service. According to the eyewitness, week after week the whistle would blow and the church members grew to dread the sounds they heard. The screams tormented them. So what did they do? Well, as the train approached and in anticipation of the screams from the boxcarred Jews, the Christians sang their hymns louder to drown out the screams. Soon, they could hear them no more. The eyewitness ended his account by describing the torment of hearing the train whistle in his sleep for the rest of his life, and pleaded for forgiveness for not only himself, but for all of those who called themselves Christians, but did nothing to intervene. Regardless of your faith or station in life, chances are great that you are exactly like that eyewitness, and equally, if not more, accountable for the actions of our government today. What is coming is going to be far worse than the world has ever seen, and is going to blindside many. Don't be one of them. A global war of unimaginable atrocities is being planned as I write this. It has been in the works for some time, yet few will want to read what Mr. Hagman has written. Rather, most will instead choose to sing louder, to drown out the screams of innocence, except this time. The screams will be too loud, too frequent, and too many. The United States of America has been overtaken from within by a group of heartless and soulless individuals making up an agency government with designs on reshaping the world into a state of global governance. They pass regulations, tax us, seize our properties and ideas, fine us, and shut down our businesses by the thousands each month. And yet you have no representation in that government. They are not elected by us. They do not answer to us. And when they are caught in their unconstitutional activities, they take the fifth and refuse to answer while still receiving their six-figure incomes made of your tax dollars. They are members of both political parties, and part of their plans include reshaping America to work for them, and empowering the Middle East at any cost, including the inevitable and incalculable cost of human life. Each agency is run by a secretary that has broad interpretive powers over the laws under which they operate their corporate control over America. Each of these secretaries answers to only one man, the president. Currently at the helm is Barack Hussein Obama, although his way was paved by the majority of his predecessors and elected officials of both parties. He was purposely selected as the man for the job to ensure that the inappropriately celebrated Arab Spring that swept North America and the Middle East was conducted as planned. It was a staged and orchestrated event by the globalists and those in power in the U.S. and elsewhere. Using your tax dollars and in your name, the United States has been providing funding and operational support to the groups toppling governments in favor of radical Islamic control. Although millions upon millions of Middle Eastern citizens are protesting this very night, such control is nothing but a necessary means to an end. While many correctly decry the brutality of Islam, few realize that is a tool of the globalists. We, the people, are not thinking big enough. The lie is bigger than you have been told. As I have previously written, a window of understanding or a glimpse into this agenda exists in the murderous events that took place in Benghazi on September 11th, 2012. Full disclosure into this event would reveal a criminal enterprise so vast and staggering that it would eclipse anything we've ever seen. Benghazi was not about any film or a protest or even a kidnapping operation. It was about weapons smuggling to Syria to assist Islamic terrorists to topple Assad, install a Muslim Brotherhood-backed regime, causing further regional destabilization leading to a massive global war. Full disclosure would reveal that the United States, through the approval of members of both political parties, we elected and acting in our name, are siding with associates that have direct ties to Al-Qaeda and other Islamic groups. We are feeding them at this very hour weapons, money, and military support. The truth is sickening, revolting, and shocking, and undeniable. There are those who doubt this agenda, instead opting to believe that we are seeing inevitable sectarian violence that existed in that part of the world for centuries. While the matter of sectarian violence is indeed a factor, the U.S. has been funding, training, and equipping the anti-Assad forces, the most well-trained of which are al-Qaeda soldiers, to accomplish a takeover of the world's oil-rich nations. Again, this is the reason no elected official wants to open an unbiased investigation into Benghazi, for it will reveal the extent of our complicity and the blood on their hands. There is no amnesty for these crimes. There is no backing down now for them. They are now fully compromised, and you will soon see men and women whom you once trusted say and stand for positions you thought impossible to believe. For anyone doubting what is on the immediate horizon, I would like to direct your attention to a picture I first saw published on the website Before It's News last week. Now, I can't show you the picture on the radio, but the picture accompanies a graphic video and tells the story of an innocent, crying, and distraught four-year-old girl chained to a fence by the anti-Assad Islamic terrorists, our side, the very group the United States is funding. Perhaps you've seen it. She was chained to the fence and forced to watch the decapitation and dismemberment of her parents, whose only crime was being a member of the Shia sect. She was a witness. Who on earth could she tell? No one. Certainly not you. She was there to tell God of what was being done without remorse. It was as though they were daring him to strike out at them. He did not come. He was in a far corner of the universe, weeping. These are the people our elected leaders, our State Department, and our CIA, at the direction of Barack Hussein Obama, are helping. These are the people who claim to be on the side of righteousness. By exacerbating the violence under the pretext of fighting oppression, worse, they are intentionally engaging in these evil and unspeakable acts in our name and with our tax dollars. At the same time, there is an active plan to fully destroy our economy by killing our national currency and driving into extinction the entrepreneurial spirit of our people by starving them of capital. This is being done not only to stop any meaningful opposition to a global system of governance through our financial enslavement, but to ensure that our future generations are beholden to a global financial power as well. Indeed, your children don't even remember what it was like to be free, to speak, to assemble, and to stand for truth. Our leadership lies and cheats and flaunts their opulence in our faces like the kinds of old kings, while we are entertained with races and games and provided a 1 in 23 million chance to join them through lotteries that drain the poor and the stupid of their last few dollars. Concurrently, and part of the larger picture, we have allowed the moral fabric of our nation to become ripped by last week's Supreme Court decision on destroying the sanctity of marriage, while at the same time mandating the commercial support of infanticide by spending billions on abortion mills to kill the children of the poor by the millions. It is said a picture is worth a thousand words. I believe the picture of this small four-year-old witness says it all. It represents the evil we have become by singing louder instead of taking action. As uncomfortable as it will make you feel, I urge you to think about this picture of the little girl. It is you, and it is your children that are numbed by this brazen violence against humanity. But by the grace of God, that could be your little girl. If more people fail to awaken, it could very well be. We must not choose to cover the screams by merely singing louder, but by making a choice. Are we going to allow this evil to progress unabated, or are we going to take a stand? The time is running out as World War III looms on the horizon. I appreciate your patience with that. I have a good friend named David Martin. His website is Inverted Alchemy. He wrote me this morning and asked me to put this on the program, which I agreed. It's entitled National Secrets, Treasure or Treason, and it goes like this. Sitting in the mist just north of the Eiger Munk and Jungfrau Mountains in Wilderswil, that's in Switzerland, I watched the momentary afternoon sun concede to the onslaught of rain that soaked me early in the day. The dense fog erased the glaciers, then the rocky crags, and then the nubile clouds dropped curtains of rain, blocking everything beyond the closest tree line. Shrouded in their watery vapor, these sentinel mountains vanished. Switzerland's notoriety as a state of discretion and secrecy was, in modern times, highly valued, as the 1934 Swiss Banking Act shielded countless assets from enemies of the Nazi state, notably continental European corporate and Jewish deposits from occupied countries. Secrecy and privacy, as constitutional rights under Article 13 of the Swiss Federal Constitution, affords absolute protection of citizens' private and family life. Swiss banking and securities professionals are prohibited from breaching confidential client information, Article 47 of the Banking Act and Article 43 of the Federal Act on Stock Exchanges and Securities Trading. Swiss secrecy predated the scourge of Nazi Germany by several hundred years. Swiss cantons were both the sanctuary and crucible for the 16th century religious reformers who, together with their patrons, sought to move life and wealth to safety in the mountain state. On the lam, arising from charges of ecclesiastical treason and heresy, Swiss resident John Calvin opened the door to a credible usury, which created an ethical loophole for Protestant bankers to exploit. Catholic and Protestant bankers alike all found this more expansive interpretation of canonical sin desirable. Discretion regarding the identities of their valued depositors during a period of religious and political upheaval was a helpful corollary to solidify the Swiss primacy of fiduciary secrecy. Reminiscent of the conditions giving rise to Swiss secrecy in the era of Calvin and Zwingli, and the codification of the same on the eve of war, secrecy and treason have once again vaulted onto the awkward international stage. The Swiss National Council just rejected Lex USA, a bill that would have aligned Swiss rules with the demand in the U.S. Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. It's affectionately called FATCA. It could be Fat Cat, but it's FATCA. While the U.S. will undoubtedly pierce the Swiss veil to go after tax evaders, together with their EU taxation counterparties, one cannot avoid the paradoxical timing of this simmering conflict. The U.S. wants disclosure of information from Swiss bankers at the same time it seeks to prosecute information disclosure by Booz Allen Hamilton, former employee turned temporary Moscow airport resident Edward Snowden. Apparently, the self-evident truths version of truth and truth are not compatible. If it serves the corporate objectives of Obama's powers that be, then we want as much information as possible. If it could incriminate them for treasonous acts against the U.S. national interests, like disclosing intelligence, covert operations, and covert financing, well, then we want to lock up the leaker. Incoming National Security Advisor Susan Rice assured the public that Snowden's activities had not weakened the president. That's true, given that many of the programs outlined in Snowden's leaky goodie bag likely predate this administration, it's reasonable to assume that Obama's Guantanamo-perpetuating willy-nilly drone assassination reputation won't be further tarnished. Maybe she hasn't been fully briefed on what the Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and Joint Chiefs of Staff General Martin Dempsey seem to know. But in a time when the Internal Revenue Service is rushing to deal with damage control on its identity targeting, with the president justifying violations to fundamental constitutional rights, and with a runner in Moscow with secrets that are either trivial or of dire consequence if leaked, I'm fascinated by the myth and mystique of secrets. What's in a secret? And why do we presume that they are a necessary component of the social order? The notion that a democratic representational power, such as a country, can only secure itself through opacity is oxymoronic. Undercover representational government is somewhere between offensively elitist and fascist. It is contrary to the principles of commerce, willing buyers and sellers informed of all material facts, contract, fully informed counterparties, and community, consensus to an established stated order. There's no surprise, then, that it is fiduciary interests, not representational governments, that need secrecy. Our paternalistic lords know that if they were operating in full transparency, neither they nor their benefactors would enjoy the benign endorsement of the taxed and the governed. For Switzerland, there's a fraction of 10.3% of its economy derived from the financial sector that's riding on secrecy. For the U.S., there's at least that much or more riding on keeping the national defense and central intelligence budget and their contractors secret. And for we the people, it may be time to actually step into the light and break the tyrannical illusion that secrecy is in our best interest. As long as we espouse its merits, we're subject to its oppression and misuse. Prioritizing transparency and accountability within ourselves and our communities will diminish the value of opacity. And lest I be misinterpreted, I'm not suggesting that discretion and privacy need to be abandoned in interpersonal relationships. But in positions of stewarded power and accountability, secrecy should have no quarter, for in its precinct thrives treachery and treason, which knows no rank, office, or distinction. That was my friend David Martin. His website is invertedalchemy.com. I think you'll enjoy it. He also wrote a book under two titles. One is The Apostles of Power, and the other, same book, is Coup d'Etoile. It's a novel, But trust me, the names have only been changed to protect the guilty. Everything in the book is, for all intents and purposes, factual. Fine, I want to round out this hour because we've... Excuse me, let me take a sip of my wonderful orange juice on ice. By the way, we've been kind of undergoing a little monsoon here in North Carolina. It dumped 4 inches in 1 hour day before yesterday. And if you like tropical conditions, you need to come here. My heart goes out to the people in Arizona and in Nevada who are suffering in three-digit temperatures. But we told you, the weather is becoming more extreme. And that is just because climate change is upon us, and there's little anyone can do about it. By climate change, I mean that the winters are becoming more wintry, and the summers, well, I'll put it this way. I saw a bird lift off from a telephone pole the other day and just burst into flames when it got airborne. You get the idea. Humans spend, in this country, about 15% of their time outdoors. A little more when the weather's nice, about 2 or 3 months a year. But the rest of the year, it's practically inclement if you want to dress nice or do something other than be on the beach. We have an interesting story. It's on the algorithm of precious metals. This story I call the Bear of Gold. The collapse in the price of gold has surprised many investors, but it really shouldn't be a surprise for those who know their financial history. Gold closed at an all-time high of $1,895 on September 5th of 2011. It had dropped to $1,690 a year later, and today it is at $1,229.20. That is poverty and devastation when you're talking about gold traders. I saw an article today that said that gold was trading below the value of production. Most of the gold in the U.S. is mined with what's known as placer mines. They're not, you know, gold mines like we had in 1890 in San Francisco, where you, you know, make a shaft into a mountain, you find a gold vein, and you just haul it out by the buckets. This is done with earth scrapers. You know, you've seen them out there, excavators. It's kind of a twist in the middle kind of machine that has a blade that comes out and scrapes up a certain amount of earth, and then a conveyor that takes that up into a big pan, and then that goes off to another area, and they reverse the process and lay the dirt down. Well, these particular scrapers, they dump the dirt into a sluicing system, in which the heavy gold is brought out the bottom and the rest is leached out by chemicals. For it to be productive, these scrapers usually will return, somewhere around a fifth of an ounce of gold per ton of dirt. And that's profitable at yesterday's prices of gold. At today's prices of gold, it isn't profitable because three things have to take place. First of all, you have to spend the energy to run the heavy equipment, pay the drivers 24 hours a day to scrape that stuff up, pay the operation of the sluicing and all the EPA permits that go with it. Then you have to take the dirt that's left over and you have to lay it back down and you have to reclaim it. It means you have to sow grass on it or trees or something. So it's an expensive process that can be profitable if the price of gold is high. But you know, while the gold bugs often cite as a basis for the predictions that the real price of gold is based on the 1980 peak of $850, would be well over $2,000, that's choosing as their basis the peak of the bubble. That's the equivalent of basing a forecast on the NASDAQ using the March 2000 peak of more than $5,000 as your base and saying that the NASDAQ is way undervalued. I don't think anyone would make that argument, yet it's made all the time about gold and also about silver. Silver is supposed to be approximately one-tenth the value of gold, which is utterly ridiculous. There's way more gold reserves than there are silver reserves. Silver is used industrially in all kinds of stuff, from cell phones to touch pads to photographic film, although most of it's digital now, and in electronics. So industrially, silver is consumed, you know, in massive amounts. Silver is not mined in massive amounts. In fact, most of the silver mines have shut down because the silver is just too darn cheap. Today, or I'd say Friday, it was somewhere around just under $20 an ounce. Of course, you can't buy it for $20 an ounce. You could buy the bullion, which is the paper. It's a little certificate that says you somebody has your silver in a vault, and you apparently own it. Yeah, you and five other people own the same ounce of gold. But the physical metal, even though the price is somewhere around $20 an ounce, you can't buy it for that. You can't go to eBay. You can't go to Apmex. You can't go to any of the precious metal dealers and buy gold for $20 an ounce. You're still going to spend $22, $23, $25 an ounce if, that's if, you can find it. Well, wait a minute. If you have scarcity of a metal and you have high demand for a metal, shouldn't the price go up? Well, here's another warning. Momentum is the tendency of assets that have done well recently to continue to do well for a while longer, and vice versa. If they've done poorly, they're going to do poorly again and continue to do so. It has been well documented across a wide range of assets. Clearly, the momentum in gold is negative. Here's another fact to consider. Momentum is a short-term phenomenon, and it doesn't bode well for gold. It's also important to remember that momentum leads to reversals in the long term. Assets that performed well over a long period tend to subsequently underperform, and vice versa. Another warning, as gold soared over the past decade, it's important to acknowledge that the forecasted collapse of the price of gold was well known. In fact, while not shocked by the price drop, most people are surprised that it came without the Federal Reserve's tightening monetary policy. It was Fed Chairman Paul Volcker's decision to drive up real interest rates that led to the demise of gold in 1980. It was Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan's decision to suppress rates in 2003 that led to gold's resurrection. But again, the crystal ball is cloudy. With that said, the advice remains the same. If you invest in gold because you value diversification benefits gold can provide, hedging the risks of loose monetary policy and some geopolitical events, it's perfectly appropriate to have a small amount of your portfolio in gold as part of your asset allocation plan. Just be sure that you are disciplined in rebalancing, not one who gets caught up in the noise and emotions the noise can create. The other thing to note is that there are short traders out there who are driving the price of gold down, and they're driving the price of silver down so they can make good on their short contracts. Keep in mind that J.P. Morgan Stanley is managing over 300,000 short contracts on silver, and yet they have the largest silver vault in the world. I will play this quick, this very quick audio piece. And then we'll close out the hour. Here we go.
It's not really possible to short Bitcoin, the virtual currency that's got everyone in a tizzy this week, much as you'd love to. Gold, however, that other haven for the disaffected, is a different matter. The gold price is down 19% since its 2011 peak, and it's accelerating. We're pretty close to a bear market. A number of forces have combined to sour the outlook for the precious metal, and none of them seems likely to abate anytime soon. Even the writers of the GFMS Gold Survey, which gamely predicts a rise back above $1,800 by year-end, gave their prediction an air of the last hurrah. Those fears that have driven gold higher, they say, worries over the Eurozone, the US fiscal situation, and the global economy. Yes, all of these will abate, GFMS says, just not yet. But sentiment may be shifting faster than that, which is why European brokers in particular seem ready to call time on the bull run. Gold, which trades in dollars, is getting relatively more expensive. The Bank of Japan may have arrived late to the drunken party that is quantitative easing, but new Governor Kuroda is immediately the life and soul. In fact, his new monetary policy is the equivalent of ripping your shirt off and dancing on the tables. The European and English central bank governors are also hanging around the drinks cabinet with varying enthusiasm. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke's next move, by contrast, will be to dilute the US punch bowl and row back on quantitative easing. That contrast and the plodding improvement of the US economy explains why the dollar index is up 5% since the end of January. Gold traded essentially sideways throughout the Cyprus crisis, and that's a pretty poor show for a supposed safe haven. It's a bad sign, too, of things to come as the world's financial system heals.
And I agree with that. We're seeing the dollar strengthen against other currencies, the rupee and others. We have about 10% more buying power than we had a couple of months ago. My advice, take advantage of it. If you can find the precious metals, if you don't have any in your portfolio, that is to say your stash of cash at your house, I recommend getting your hands on the physical metal. Do not buy bullion. And remember, once you buy metal, you own it. And most people that have metal, unless things really go south, they don't sell it. That's why they call it a storage metal. So when you buy the silver, buy the gold, put it in a safe place in your house, although be cautious. My son's house was broken into 2 weeks ago, and they rifled everything very carefully, very methodically, stole all of his cash, and of course, all of his silver bars. Find a little safer place for it. Put it in a heat vent or under the sink in a container that's normally used for something else. The safest way to keep your money safe. No one is going to look inside of a box of dishwashing powder. All right, let's go ahead and take a break. We'll be back with another hour of X Squared Radio right after this. Don't go away.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor coming, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun. There was floating on the breeze. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 20th century. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 20th century. I was lying in a burned out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like I could cry. I was thinking hoping it was a lie, thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Saw the silver spaceships flying,
in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen ones, all in a dream, all in a dream. The loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver sea to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver sea to a new
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live this June 30th, 2013, from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast is rain. Much needed rain. Appreciate you hanging around the first hour. Very, very powerful stuff. This 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. Our phone lines, anywhere in North America, you can call us free, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Any feelings or comments about the last hour? A very, very powerful stuff. Yes, it's supposed to be a wake-up call. That's why you listen to BBS Radio, because if it's not mainstream, it's probably right here on BBS Radio. BBS Radio Network has more audio content than any webcast network on the planet. And that's due large part, almost completely, solely large part, for the love and dedication that Don and Doug have for this genre. My heart goes out to them, my appreciation to them. They're suffering through this climate change. No air conditioning, but imbibing on whatever it takes to keep themselves cool this evening. So we're with them. By the way, if you feel the compunction to become a talk radio personality, this is a good place to start. And if you want a little help in that, you can contact me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. And I will be happy to help you get sponsored. To get on to the BBS Radio Network. It isn't prohibitively expensive, and if you think you have what it takes, you have the voice, you have the will, you have the ability to come up with content every time your program comes up, then have at it. About 1,000 new personalities come on the web every quarter, and about 1,001 leave. But that's okay. You're welcome to try, and I have several on the BBS Radio Network that we have helped get there, and they're still there, still hanging in there. Anywhere else outside of the U.S., on planet or off planet, actually, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us, 530-413-9537. And you can call and talk about almost anything, but if we would prefer that you stay with the program's content this hour, I have a GMO update. Many of you have learned to like these, and I have received lots of mail from people around the world who are interested in this subject and its various corruptions. I have about 54 pages of content tonight. I can only get through about 33. So some of this I'm going to cherry pick, and it's not going to make it live tonight. But if you would like to have the content, it's all in one file. I have arranged it in the order that I will or will not speak about it tonight. And you can have it. I'll email it to you gladly, because all of the authors of the various pieces and my comments are to be disseminated. And we give credit where credit is due. And I will email it back to you. Just write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, and I will be happy to send it to you. Also, don't forget that yours truly has been the six-time Amazon best-selling author, and actually one of those books made it to the top 100 twice, so I guess you could say I'm a seven-time Amazon best-selling author. And the books are on various websites. Of course, you can get them at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all of those websites. But if you order them from my websites, you will not only get the book, but you get the audio version for free. I'll send it to you autographed. You can put it on your shelf, and then you can also listen to it in the car or on your favorite device. Those books, beginning with the most recent one, Alienated Nation, The New Path to Liberty, is, of course, at alienatednation.com. And the one before that is Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. And that is at rememberingthefuturebook.com because it is also the basis for an upcoming major motion picture. And that will be rememberingthefuturemovie.com. We're not ready to disclose that yet, but the screenplay is quite promising, and I may even turn the screenplay into a novel just to give it a more round presence. So be sure to pick those up. Be happy to send them to you. They're affordable. They are entertaining and may actually change the universe, which is what they're designed to do. All right, my GMO update. A recent study conducted by a German university found very high concentrations of glyphosate. Glyphosate is a carcinogenic chemical, by the way. It's found in herbicides such as Monsanto's Roundup in all urine samples tested. Not some, all of them. The amount of glyphosate found in the urine was staggering, with each sample containing concentrations of 5 to 20 times the limit established for drinking water. Yeah, like there should even be a limit in drinking water. How about none? Anyway, this is just one more piece of evidence that herbicides are, at the very least, being sprayed out of control. Herbicides kill the weeds that compete with plants for the nutrients in the soil. And although we wash everything and, you know, everything is processed correctly according to government standards, FDA, some of the Roundup gets in the food. The corn, the cantaloupe, whatever it is that you buy, you're going to get some of that Roundup in there. Now, Monsanto makes Roundup, but they also make a genetically modified version of many, many organisms that are called Roundup Ready. That is to say, you can spray Roundup on the field and the plants will not be affected by the Roundup because they're bred, they're genetically designed to resist the Roundup. Everything else, it kills. Not good. This news comes only 1 month after it was found that glyphosate contained in Monsanto's Roundup is contaminating the groundwater in areas in which it is used. What does this mean? Well, it means that when it's sprayed on the crops and then it rains and that rainwater runs off of that land or it runs out of the food processing plant into the water, it makes it back into the groundwater, which ends up going into the drinking water, wells and water treatment plants before it's put back in the pipes and you drink it. And most of, if not all of, the water treatment plants do not remove glyphosate. So it is now polluting the world's drinking water through the widespread contamination of aquifers, wells, springs. The recent reports of glyphosate showing up in all urine samples only enhances these past findings. Monsanto continues to make the claim that their Roundup products are completely safe for both animals and humans. However, many environmentalists, scientists, activists, talk radio hosts, and even doctors say otherwise. Glyphosate radically affects the metabolism of plants in a negative way. It is a systemic poison, preventing the formation of essential amino acids, leading to weakened plants which ultimately die from it. It's weed killer. A formula seems to have been made to not only ruin the agricultural system but also compromise the health of millions of people worldwide. Once this carcinogenic chemical is made, it doesn't fall apart. It stays together through sunlight, through snow, through runoff, all the way through the water treatment plant, back into the drinking water, and it's becoming more and more concentrated because as you drink the water, you also expel the water, which goes down the sewage, out to the water, the sewage treatment plant, and goes back into the aquifer. So it continues to increase with every ton of this stuff that is sprayed on farms all over the world. With the invent of Monsanto's Roundup Ready crops, resistant superweeds are taking over farmland and public health is being attacked. As it turns out, glyphosate is also leaving behind its residue in the Roundup Ready crops, causing further potential concern for public health. Glyphosate is even contributing to escalating rates of mental illness and obesity through the depletion of beneficial gut flora. In other words, it's an herbicide in your intestines that directly regulates these functions. But it certainly doesn't stop there. Researchers tested Roundup on mature male rats at a concentration range between 1 and 10,000 parts per million, and found that within 1 to 48 hours of exposure, testicular cells of the mature rats were either damaged or killed. Even at a concentration of 1 part per million, the Roundup was able to affect the test subjects by decreasing their testosterone concentrations by as much as 35%. Now, Earth Explorers, these are laboratory facts. These are quantitative analysis that are done using HPLC, high-pressure liquid chromatography. It is repeatable. It is quantitative and very, very accurate. And what we're trying to explain here is that globally, in the male population of humans, we are seeing a drastic drop in sperm count. Now, excuse me while I take a sip of my orange juice, organic orange juice. Okay, that was a gulp, not a sip. That's okay. The point I'm trying to make here is almost every hour on every radio program on the AM band, and even most of the FM bands, we hear ads for different kinds of all-natural supplements that you can take to increase your testosterone, increase your sex drive, increase your performance in the sack. The reason that we're seeing all these ads is because the testosterone level in men is dropping. It's dropping because, as you have just heard, concentrations of 1 part per million in drinking water drops the testosterone concentrations in the body by as much as 35%. Now, that is not going to be replaced by any all-natural supplement. I hate to tell you, the only way to get more testosterone in the male physiology is to inject it. It's called a steroid, my friends. That's right. You juice the butt. You take a needle and you jab it in your butt cheek once a day, and it will replace the testosterone that you're losing. With a little bit more concentration, and you will bulk up some serious muscle, and you will shave the fat off your body. You're also probably going to pick up a really bad attitude because testosterone tends to make people very aggressive. It also gives you acne, so be careful. Now, the issue is that genetically modified organisms by Monsanto is messing with the biosphere. It's messing with the ecology. We're not talking rats here. We're talking humans. Humans consume that water. Humans consume these foods and eat them. And the concentration of this Roundup herbicide is killing the flora, killing the natural stuff in your gut, which controls obesity. Now, humans have all kinds of bacteria in their intestines, just like cows do. In fact, if it were to really be thought about, humans pretty much live off the work that the bacteria do in the gut. Now, there are different levels of the gut. You have the small intestine and you have the large intestine and you have the colon. But the small intestine is divided into areas that do different parts of the biochemical work of nourishing the human body. Lean bacteria is what it's called, need to exist in the forward part of the gut. What this does is it takes the food that you eat and it breaks the food down into more, let's just call it basic building blocks. If that bacteria is not present in the front of the gut, what will happen is the body will assimilate that food and store it in the form of fat. And it forms and stores in your butt and in your gut and in your love handles. And if you can distribute fat well enough all over your body, you can put on 20 or 30 pounds of fat. And it won't really show, except in the sense that you're wearing 40-inch pants and a 48-inch jacket. You're going to be a big guy. And if you're having trouble losing that last 20 pounds or 30 pounds, it's probably because you don't have that lean bacteria in the front part of your gut. It's dead. It's gone. So you need to take some bacterial supplements or like something like yogurt or something to get your gut producing or at least renting property to the right kind of bacteria in the front side of your gut so that these lean bacteria can work for you. If they're not there, it doesn't matter if you cut your calorie intake to 1,200 calories a day. Guess what? You're still going to be fat. That's right. So this is what is happening. These genetically modified foods are doing three things to us. First of all, they are lowering our sperm counts and our testosterone levels in the males. Second, they are making you uncontrollably fat. And the third is that they are making you a toxic being. These chemicals are accumulating in the tissues of your body. And when it starts affecting the, let's call it the ability for the human to procreate, your procreative abilities, your abilities to have kids, it starts slowing that down, it's going to have a statistical effect. It's going to change the median age of the population. Ooh, guess what? Just got a report in. The median age in the United States is back up to 37. 37! Are you kidding me? That is a massive shift in the median age of a country. Yes, we're living to be older, and there are a lot more older Americans, but 300 million of us in the median age is 37? Get out of town. Where are all the kids? Well, now you know. Have you ever used Roundup to kill weeds in your lawn or garden? As the most widely used herbicide in the United States, and it is distributed across this country, not by the ton, by the hundreds of tons a day, there's a good chance that you have ingested lots of this herbicide. In fact, millions of pounds are used every year on U.S. gardens, lawns, and extensively on farms growing genetically modified Roundup-ready crops. You hear the ads all the time in the agricultural communities. Now, if you live in the cities, you're probably not going to hear these ads. But if you go out in the country, you go out in wheat-growing country or soybean-growing country, you're going to hear those ads. They're going to be on the early morning radio or at lunchtime or on the weekends. You're going to hear about Roundup-ready stuff. Now, you may forget about the herbicide soon after you spray it and may never give it a second thought about when consuming corn chips or cereal or countless other processed foods like pizza or tacos that contain Roundup-ready corn and soy, but it doesn't just magically disappear. Instead, new research is showing that glyphosate, the active ingredient in Monsanto's Roundup herbicide, is contaminating everything from food and air to groundwater and even, yes, even human beings. Research, this German research is unbelievable. Now, I've already told you what differences it makes in the gut. But there's an alarming finding that glyphosate is easily one of the world's most overlooked poisons. Research published in 2010, 3 years ago, showed that this chemical, which works by inhibiting an enzyme called EPSP, it's synthase, that's the enzyme. It's necessary for plants to grow. It helps them complete photosynthesis, which is the conversion of sunlight and CO2 into sugar. It causes birth defects in frogs and chicken embryos at far lower levels than used in agricultural and garden applications. Now, here are the malformations that are primarily found in these birth defects. Skull, face, midline and developing brain, and the spinal cord. Quite shockingly, the amount of glyphosate residue you can be exposed to through food is remarkably high. In terms of being close to the maximum residue limit, that's the MRL in chemical speak, allowed, according to a report in the journal Chemical Research and Toxicology, the highest MRL for glyphosate in food and feed products in the EU is 20 milligrams per kilogram. GM soybeans have been found to contain residues as high as 17 milligrams per kilogram. That's really, really close. And malformations in frog and chicken embryos occur at 2 milligrams per kilogram. In other words, the toxicology standard is 10 times that's necessary to cause malformations in frog and chicken embryos, 10 times. Other independent scientific research has also found that glyphosate has the potential to cause grave health damage, including a 2009 study 4 years ago that tested formulations of Roundup that were highly diluted, and by diluted I mean up to 100,000 times or more, on human cells. And even then, the cells died within 24 hours. Yeah, it's poison. The researchers hailed a warning cry that still has not been heard by regulators around the world, who continue to allow massive amounts of Roundup to be sprayed into the environment. Quote, the proprietary mixtures available on the market could cause cell damage and even death around residual levels to be expected, especially in food and feed derived from Roundup-formulated treated crops. Close quote. Not to mention, when applied to crops, glyphosate becomes systemic throughout the plant. That means it can't be washed off. It goes into the plant. And once you eat the crop, the glyphosate ends up in your gut, where it can decimate your beneficial bacteria, can wreak havoc with your health, as 80% of your immune system resides in your gut. That's right. The gut is gut-associated lymph tissue and is dependent upon a healthy ratio of good and bad bacteria. Separate research has also uncovered the following effects from glyphosate. It goes on, and I think it gets into some more complicated physiology here, and I don't want to go on to it. Now you get the point. It is not just the genetically modified food that's bad for you, messing with the DNA, bringing in stuff from jellyfish and cabbage and putting it in other plants, you know, to help it be able to live with less water or be able to live in colder climates or to be able to live in nutrient-depleted soils or to resist insects or, in this case, to be able to resist the herbicide that's being sprayed on them. And my good friend Alexander says that the entire plan is there to limit the population. And there's a good argument for that, because I can tell you, the population is going to be affected. He says 2.5 mentally handicapped children per family was their goal the last time I looked it up. What's your brand of rat poison? LOL. Good job, Alexander. Exactly correct. In other words, it's perfectly acceptable to have 2.5 mentally handicapped children per family. Don't think so. We used to see 2.5 handicapped kids per school when I was a kid. We don't see that now. Now it's, what, 1 in 80? A 1 in 80 chance of having a child with autism. Excuse me while I take a sip of my wonderful orange juice. So what's it going to take? Is it going to take an all-out revolt? Well, I've got a little piece from my good friend Sasha. I'm going to share this with you here. Hold on a second. It's slightly out of order. Here we go. Sasha is a good friend of mine. He is a former rock star from South Africa. Amazing diction. That's the ability to say the English word. Lots of people speak English. Few people have mastered it. Sasha is one of the masters. Very, very intelligent person, opinionated, as you will see in this piece. Now, I will ask for your forgiveness in advance for his eloquence, but nonetheless, I think you'll get the gist of it. Midsummer falls upon us, and in the shadow of a people's revolution, ocean bowls off the Egyptian coast reveal the sunken city of Heraklion. Like timeless ghosts, ancient colossi of Isis and Hapi break surface from their watery graves, touch air for the first time in millennia, and breathe again within the mortal realm. Primeval totems of reconstitution, so perfectly timed, symbolizing the rebirth of a long, downgraded, dispossessed, and glorious race of humans. Like the Rosetta Stone or Dead Sea Scrolls, coughed up from Coptic catacombs, these pivotal archetypes of our future past emerge just in time to rewire history and remind our luckless civilization how very little we know of ourselves and one another. A Turkish sultan trapped in the body of a mere prime minister glances in the direction of Taksim Square as his people demand fresh air and trees over shopping malls and consumer mind control. The silken suited, tie-pinned, shiny-shoed, glossy-haired sock puppet broadcasts a dictum to the mothers of his nation, directs them to retrieve protesting family members to the safety of home. The mothers head to Taksim Square and form a human chain, protect their families from the stormtroopers. Edragon the Great uses the world's media to bleat to the world's media that social networking is to blame. Tells his people, move along now, nothing to see here, as state-sponsored terrorism disguised as police fire gas canisters point blank into the skulls of pretty girls gathered in the sunshine. Pressure hoses laced with chemical poison smash young men into the pavements until they are dead, broken and dead. That's what happens when you permit your government to play with sharp instruments. The people gather still, flowers in their arms this time. Syria and Iran stand sentinel as the last firewall between us and Armageddon. End of days has already been visited on them, as it has Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and other oil resource-rich developing nations. More than 110,000 private security contractors operate in Afghanistan alone. That's government-sanctioned mercenaries to you and I, foreign terrorists to the native people, crop-haired goons in camouflage wielding guns, an ad hoc cherry-picking militia operating on behalf of U.S. and Western commercial interests, kids who didn't grow up in ways that matter, didn't suckle sufficiently on the tit, boys with toys, having little or no accountability to the lawless agencies which sanction them. They shoot to kill. They plunder like the horrendous Vikings of old. And on the other side of the world, a man stands up, clears his voice, and wishes to be heard. Professor Henry Graff, arguably Columbia University's most distinguished and honored professor with a 46-year tenure of service. The diplomatic history professor at the time of Obama's graduation states simply, "I'm very upset by the whole story. I don't consider him a Columbia student. I have no idea what he did on the Columbia campus. No one knows him." All the students who gathered recently at their 30th college reunion remain equally confused at the legend. Nobody met him or saw him or can remember him at all. Columbia alumni or not, it appears that Obama is no longer a lawyer in any event, having surrendered his license back in 2008 in order to escape charges he lied on his bar application. A voluntary surrender of license is a last-ditch option when you've been accused of something serious in order to avoid having the state suspend you. Curiously enough, Michelle Obama's voluntarily surrendered her license as well in 1993 after a federal judge gave her the choice between surrendering it or standing trial for insurance fraud. These factual events chillingly suggest that the most powerful man on earth is at the heart of a diabolical conspiracy. A man who has not, in real terms, supplied sufficient paperwork as evidence of identity to qualify him as a groundskeeper at the White House, let alone commander-in-chief. It suggests elements within the global military-industrial complex and intel community tagged to the deal. Suggests an insidious program of illegal public surveillance, covert mainstream media control, and gross manipulation by a shadow government. A few short months since the 2012 winter solstice, where our blue pearl planet conjuncted the intersection of the Milky Way and the plane of the ecliptic, resurrecting us from a 13,000-year galactic sleep cycle, and the contrast between sheer good and evil becomes apparent to all but the terminally unconscious. It is a time when the world of men busy themselves with the pursuit of trivia, whilst the antics of insane leaders pass unnoticed. A time when a man empowered to murder innocent people across the globe with remote-controlled drones holds the Nobel Peace Prize. A time when the bravest among us, whistleblowers risking life and limb, take up the cross of humanity and are hunted down for treason. A time when a man can be extradited as a spy for revealing to the public that its elected government is unlawfully spying. It is a time when war protesters get arrested for disturbing the peace. A time when the gravest of all insults to civilization, those privately owned commercial enterprises called government, are so deeply embedded in mechanistic survival that they articulate almost all the evils prevalent in our world. Hunger, poverty, murder, genocide, environmental rape, disintegration of families and communities, and dereliction of the most precious commodity of all, human sovereignty. It is indeed a time of high treason, where the most powerful leaders of nations all but declare war on their own citizens. They draft codes, statutes, and ordinances which revile the very rule of law. They conspire to usurp God-given rights and protections afforded the common man by desecrating the Constitution, which mandate their own powers. Thus, Barack Hussein Obama, a.k.a. Barry Soetoro, an Indo-Kenyan imposter by sensible reckoning, installed at the White House, finger on the trigger of a quadrillion-dollar nuclear war machine, begins to creak and moan under the weight of his administration's sheer toxicity. He makes time each Tuesday to personally compile a death list of perceived enemies, whereupon important-looking men pluck the list from his hand and plod away on thick-piled carpet to activate drone assassinations of wedding parties taking place in foreign lands. The Clinton woman ducks out of D.C. just in time to avoid the storm she ghoulishly seeded. A clutch of old cognac-swilling Anglo-Saxons in the basement howl with laughter as their dark effigy begins to spark and pop, with the evidenced counts of treason adding up. The old new world is finally pitched, timed, and poised for the greatest fall in history. Wild and woolly conspiracy theorists exhale for the first time in years, hands swollen from having beaten the drum since long before audacity of hope and inconvenient truth was thrown at our beaming faces like psycho-intellectual slime. As the late demigod Terence McKenna warned in his last interview, in the short years ahead, as we converge toward the Ashaton, that transcendental object at the end of time, things are going to get weirder and weirder until they become so weird that we will no longer be able to ignore the weirdness. Thus we see the artifice of sectarian statehood melt in the glare of an awakening planet. Ears pressed to the ground, we hear amid the thundering footsteps McKenna's classic exhortation, "Culture is not your friend. Neither is religion, particularly if you are one of the incalculable victims who have suffered at the hands of pedophile rings issuing from the heart of the Catholic Church, or victims of church and state-sponsored genocide currently being exposed by Nobel Peace Prize nominee Reverend Kenneth Arnett, Field Secretary for the International Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State, or one of countless victims of the abuses of fundamental Islam, neo-aggressive Buddhism, etc. Like thunderbolts from Zeus, resplendent solar flares split celestial admonitions of grace at our spinning orb as Homo sapiens begin the galactic shrug of jettisoning ourselves from arcane mind control software designed to cage us within civilizational, religious, cultural, and social and mental prisons. We see ourselves in one another across those revolutionary city squares. See ourselves in one another as we shuffle along interminable security lines at the airports, as we are frisked, herded, cajoled, and terrified in a thousand ways by a grotesquerie of elites, oligarchies, and priesthoods cowering behind their armor-plated thugs wielding dangerous toys and godlessness. Exactly how weird does it get? In the USA, an eighth grade student was facing a year in prison for wearing a t-shirt with an NRA logo. In the USA, a 9-year-old child was tasered twice before being handcuffed on her own doorstep for skipping school. On May 4th, in the US, a 10-year-old boy was tasered at school by a policeman wishing to make a point about what happens to folks who don't obey orders. Official guidelines in the UK, by the way, warn of potentially fatal health problems if youths are hit by the 50,000-volt devices. Despite this, use of these shock weapons in confrontation with under-18s rose by almost 600% in 3 years. World governments spend $1.7 trillion on war in 2012. 44% of it is underwritten by the USA. It would take about $135 billion to eradicate global poverty. The U.S. ranks first in the world in global crime, rape, CO2 emissions, divorce rate, teen birth rate, heart attacks, plastic surgery, prisons, and prisoners. The U.S. issue the most vaccines, and yet still has a high under 5 mortality rate. On any given night, approximately 200,000 military veterans are homeless in the United States. 22 service veterans commit suicide each day in the United States. The federal government is increasingly labeling military veterans as potential domestic terrorists. About 17,000 farmers commit suicide in India each year due to debt and crop failure, largely attributed to genetically modified crops. Monsanto genetically modified products are being banned from nations around the world for the dangers they present to food production. And yet Barack Obama has appointed a former VP of Monsanto as the food safety czar for the U.S. government. And Monsanto's chief, Robert Fraley, was granted the World Food Prize by the U.S. State Department this month. Over 2 million people in 436 cities across 52 nations marched against Monsanto and its overt abuses in May of this year. There was zero news coverage. President Barack Obama, former editor of the Harvard Law Review, is no longer a lawyer. Neither is Michelle. 20,000 Jews protested the State of Israel in Federal Plaza in New York City this month on the 9th and got zero media coverage. It is worth noting here that America, a country which merely represents all of the world, is not the bad guy, just the pathologically ignorant one at this juncture in history. True, financial, political, and intellectual power issue more directly from European houses, old bloodlines which articulated the precepts of usury and bonded slavery a long time ago. Since inception of the Federal Reserve in 1913, the U.S. dollar was birthed as the singularity toward which the wealth of all nations has been coerced or butchered into subservience. Exactly 100 years later, this year, the top 25 U.S. banks have more than $212 trillion of exposure to derivatives combined, yet only have assets totaling $8.9 trillion combined. That means exposure of the largest banks to derivatives outweigh their total assets by a ratio of 24 to 1. This is beyond financial meltdown. It is the net result of arguably the greatest deception and engineered strike against the well-being and prosperity of humanity in the history of our fragile world. We are supposed to slump into semi-consciousness when men in suits start talking derivatives, exposures, cross-collateralizations, dragnet clauses, precisely so they can continue with their mad, bad science of gutting the commonwealth, unmolested or scrutinized by you and I. And whilst the affluent raid coffers from dusk till dawn, Uncle Sam, trillions of dollars in debt, gives out billions more in foreign aid. How does that compute? The answer is that it is not aid being dispensed at all, but blood money, bribes, coercion fees, and bakshish. All is necessary and logical function in the need for the system to survive and protect itself. Even at the cost of wholesale human survival, to wit, Monsanto, the nefarious multinational enterprise seeking to mutate the world's food supply into zombie fodder, lurches from nation to nation, pumping the sweaty hands of eager diplomats whilst setting in motion global depopulation as a United Nations protocol. Old grinning billionaires stalk the international stage, their private helicopters descending amid adobe huts in African in the African veld. Worthy poses are struck in places where flies buzz around dying black babies. Desperate are some, it would seem, to get their hands on the ultimate right of engineered genocide via mass vaccination and food and water control. Bill Gates, son of the erstwhile chief of Planned Parenthood that glossed up Enterprise for eugenics, continues Daddy's great dream by pumping billions of dollars into programs which radiate the scrotums of dark-skinned men to render them sterile. Give these custodians of humankind a microphone, and without a trace of irony or guile, they will then talk up the healthy aspects of proposed death panels to determine who lives and who dies. War is a most useful tool in their visionary objectives. As for money, the stuff which measures and stores our ideas of value and exchange, did we ever wrap our sweet, stupid heads around what it really is? To divine the mysteries of the Luciferian symphony of usury, articulated deception of promissory notes printed by a club of pathological liars, lent against the currency of human bondage and the future debt of wage slaves. You and I, our time and our motion, our energy and our lives. Harvest of the innocence becomes the base tone of our civilization, as it ever was. Yet in such recognition, are we able as children of the new earth to tear down the prison walls within our feverish minds and sullied hearts? See the prison planet we permission with every non-thought and every non-action. This our world, this our death camp. Are we able to understand the idiocy of patriotism, of nationalism, of any darn ism? Can we begin to see that flexing muscle, pumping bullets and nuclear warheads into people and objects is just not cool? It's not defending anything other than evil. Protects not, but the deviants who devise and exercise this rationale. Midsummer is upon us, and it seems that amid the darkening skies of war, we are met again through the mist of ages by the steady rumble of a collapsing house of Babylon. At the onset of a catastrophe, a catastrophic failure of the modern male experiment of organizing humans with fear, time, and money, we are left so ruined, so poisoned, with little choice but to embrace the emergent other, art, beauty, and consciousness, grace, the stuff which augurs an awakening of our greater aspect, the all-seeing eye which peers not from a dollar bill in the Masonic dungeons of a dying priesthood, but which resides as the quanta in the very heart of humankind. Grace, reminding us of our capacity for remembrance and for love, reminding us of our worthiness, our beauty, and our timeless divinity. That was my friend Sasha writing to us from South Africa. Appreciate his words. I did have a couple of comments click in. Yes, I'm just going to read it. Like the ad from BYU TV where a little boy builds and launches a multi-phase rocket with a lady's voice in the background saying, "It's not who's going to let you, but who's going to stop you." The message I got from that, he says, is no matter how corrupt government gets you, can still swim against the tide of social destruction. Live free no matter what. It's only a social destruction. Oops, I'm sorry. It's only a system upheld by its citizens that can continue executing atrocities. That ridicule... Oh, that includes citizens that are law enforcement officers and military personnel. Yes, they are citizens too. They're our neighbors. If they don't support the bad government, it would collapse, and we would not, and we would fire again. Oh, we would be free again. Ours is an obese system that plays the song of the doll to manipulate a free population into bondage. Yes, maybe the song of the dole. Maybe that's what he was meaning there. Let's take a quick musical break. That's been top of the hour. I appreciate your patience and your attentiveness. Some of this stuff is very eloquent, very powerful. I suggest you play it back and listen to it again. The points are poignant, to say the least, and they're designed to get your attention. We're halfway through the year, and I expect great things from this year. We'll talk a little bit about it at the top of the hour. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
so I tried to touch. I told the truth, I didn't come to fool you. And even though it all went wrong, I'll stand before the Lord of song with nothing on my tongue but hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. Final hour. We're live June 30th, 2013. Coming to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachians, actually outside Charlotte, North Carolina. Our AccuWindow forecast is light rain, and we need the rain, so we appreciate it. I know it's going to be a hot summer coming up. It is also around the country right now. I wish this rain out in Arizona and Nevada, where you crave it so badly. Don't forget that one of our good sponsors is the Food Investor. If you're thinking about using some of your extra hours this summer toward buying something or making a good investment, I suggest investing in food. My good friends Scott and Danny out in Utah have developed a great food storage system. It is dehydrated food, but it's done without preservatives. So, very, very delicious menu and affordable. You can put it into a backpack by the front door, leave it for 25 years if you want to. And if an emergency does hit, God forbid it does not, but if it does, you will not have to rely at all on FEMA to bring you cookies and cocoa and a warm blanket, because you will have invested in your own food. That's kind of a nice way to be. So, check them out, Food Investor, at x2-radio.com. Also, I would appreciate it if you went to Amazon under my name if you want to. Brooks Agnew, all of the books that I've published are there. I would like to get some more books out there. If you would buy some, give them to a friend. I would love to have you buy a copy of Alienated Nation and send it to your governor. All we need is 40 governors to agree to hold a constitutional convention, and we can bring this whole sordid thing to an end. We don't have to rely on one or two courageous congressmen to lead us out. We can do it ourselves using the governors. One constitutional convention, one weekend, there are enough governors to hold the convention, draft and pass the amendments, and ratify them all in one weekend. And then the Supreme Court would be empowered to help us instead of making such crazy decisions like they have this week. Well, in this hour, I do want to help you out a little bit. Many of you want to know what to do. Where do I go? How do I spend my money? What do I do with it? I have told you already. I would get your money out of that 401k, pay the penalty, and take the cash. It's safer at your house, because it's only a matter of time before the federal government decides that your 401k is their 401k, and they're going to take it and give you an IOU, and there's not anything you're going to do about it. And there'll be a great ad campaign that says, don't worry about it. The faith and credit of the United States of America is behind you. You'll be able to access that money no problem at 65. Okay, 75. And I've also advised you to watch what the wealthy do, not the yachts and the planes and the gross expenditures and overeating and all of that, overindulging and stuff, but watch what they do with their money. Now, one of the things that has been very strange, what we have seen this week culminate, is that central banks actually sold a record amount of U.S. Treasury debt last week, while bond funds suffered the biggest ever investor withdrawal as markets shuddered at the prospect of the U.S. Federal Reserve ending its quantitative easing program. You know what that is, right? That's when you have a really big party, and it's an open bar. And everybody who likes to drink heads for the bar, and they drink, and they drink, and they drink. And then when they pass out and wake up, and the bar is still open, guess what? They come back and drink some more. And they're shoving it in their pockets, and they're putting it in the trunk of the car, because they're giving it out as fast as you can drink it, as fast as you can haul it out. And so what happens is the whole community ends up just getting wasted month after month. Well, that's what quantitative easing is. This is where they pump $40 to $80 billion a month into the bond markets. Now, you don't see it. It doesn't show up in your checking account. It doesn't even show up in your bank or your credit union. We're talking the central banks. This is pumped it directly into the credit markets. Holdings of U.S. Treasuries held at the Fed on behalf of official foreign institutions dropped. Get this. You can go ahead and loosen your seatbelt a little, but you'll need the room here. It dropped a record $32.4 billion to $2.93 trillion, eclipsing the prior market of $24 billion in August of 2007. $32.4 billion. It was the third week of outflows in the past four. Three out of the last 4 weeks in June. Now, private investors are also dumping fixed income. Bond funds tracked by EPFR Global, a data provider, saw total redemptions of $23.3 billion in the week of June 26th. U.S. funds were the worst hit, with withdrawing totaling about $10.5 billion. But emerging market debt funds also saw record redemptions of $5.6 billion. Now, what does this all mean? Well, it means that people are throwing in the towel, okay? It will drag the market down lower and lower over the course of the summer. So if you have been out there thinking that the economy was just rosy, everything's great, look how things are rebounding. Look at the Dow. Look at the stock market. It's doing wonderfully. Listen, I'm communicating with a guy on LinkedIn. I don't want to say his name because he actually advertises himself as a financial analyst, you know, helping people get business funding. But his knowledge of the market and his statement that the economy is doing wonderful, just look at the stock market, scares the hell out of me because they don't have a clue what's going on. Fixed income markets tumbled since Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, first signaled on May 22nd that the U.S. Central Bank would begin reducing its asset purchasing later this year. In other words, translation, people were running out of ink. We've printed all the money we can print out of sheer nothing, just fiat currency. They're not really printing money. It's all electronic, you know. They just add a few zeros. Here, have some more scotch. Have some more vodka. Gin, no problem. Have that too. They have been pumping and pumping and pumping that market all year long, and the market got drunk off the pumping. And now Ben Bernanke is saying, look, guys, you know, we thought this was going to work. We thought it would, like, you know, get out into the credit markets, but you guys are just trading the currencies back and forth. It's not getting into the market. So what's happened is that it never made its way to the manufacturer. It never made its way to the neighborhood bank. What happened was the people that invest in stocks made a freaking fortune. And people, small companies that were out there trying to raise money by selling into the market or by going public or by doing reverse mergers, they're getting killed because they're competing with these giant stocks that are just bloated with all this alcohol being pumped into their veins. Well, The noticeable rise in short-term Treasury yields, in spite of the Fed stressing it in is no hurry to tighten policy, could be the result of developing countries selling Treasury holdings to finance currency interventions. This guy, his name is Luke Crandall. He's an economist at Wrights and ICAP. He says, we can only speculate at this point about which countries were selling and what maturities were being unloaded. One obvious possibility is that emerging market nations whose currencies have been under heavy pressure sold shorter, dated currencies for intervention purposes. In other words, currency traders, what they like to do is they make lots of micro trades during the month. Now, if you have an IRA or you're manipulating or trading your own 401k, or you have, a Scottrade account or an Ameritrade account, you might go there once a week, Sunday afternoon. Let's see what stocks are doing. Oh, hey, my stock in so-and-so tire company is up. Yeah, I'm going to sell that, and I'm going to buy a stock in soybeans because the spring harvest or a summer harvest are coming in. You know, that's what you do. No. These guys do 30 to 50 trades a month, and they're executed by high-speed computer, which means, in a coordinated way, these programs do micro trades that are designed to make about 0.1% every trade, 0.1% to about 0.15, just a little bit. But remember, when you do that 50 times a month, you're making 20 to 30% on your money. Not per year, per month. Yeah, it's kind of insane, isn't it? Multiply that times 12, that's 360% a year. Now you know what I'm talking about. Why in the world would these guys want to put their money into a single stock, taking a risk with an emerging technology company, when they could just sit there and trade currencies? Trust me, that's what's going on. Citigroup's doing it. Fidelity's doing it. MassMutual is doing it. JP Morgan is doing it. And there are 100 small independent companies that are managing between $1 and $50 million accounts doing it as well. They're all trying to do the George Soros thing. Remember, George Soros made $1 billion in 1 month off the Japanese yen getting ready to short. That's what I'm talking about. That's what's driving this false sense of value in the market. And I'm saying it's a false and it's a sense. It is not the real thing. So when you watch what the wealthy are doing with their money, it gives you a clue of what is getting ready to come. Okay? Fund managers stress that the Fed is still buying billions of dollars worth of bonds for months to come, and point out that the actual interest rate increases are far away, but they're not. Home mortgage rates are already starting to climb. Those injections by the Fed are already starting to drop. It's not months away. It's weeks away. But some asset managers are concerned that if outflows continue, it could force some to sell positions once more and trigger another deeper leg in the fixed income route, particularly during the illiquid summer months. Summer is a notoriously bad time to invest. It's hot and it's shallow, and if people capitulate, then it will not be nice. Equity funds failed to benefit from the move out of fixed income, with redemptions hitting about $13 billion in this week. Japan was the only place to see the net equity inflows in the past week. But remember, Japanese investors are huge holders of U.S. Treasury debt, not the biggest. China's the biggest. And they also dumped the net $12 billion of foreign bonds last week, their biggest sale in 14 months. They're trying to recapitalize their economy, and they're doing it. They're doing it the Bernanke way. They're following his lead. But look at it. When Japan went into the recession, they went into it in the best possible shape. They had five hugely profitable corporations. They had almost no debt compared to their GDP, and employment was good. Now, 18 years later, those five companies are barely profitable. Their GDP, or their debt to GDP, is something like 226%. They're completely upside down. They have to do what they're doing to get out of their situation. So, to make a long story short, the world's banks are manipulating the biggest world economies, namely ours, the EU's, and Japan's. China is the only one that seems to be immune to this all, and that's because they haven't been in the selling end of the deal. They've been in the buying end of the deal. They don't have the debt. They own the debt, okay? They don't have mortgages. They own the mortgage. There's a huge difference. So I saw something very interesting in sports news today. I thought it would make a good analogy. A lot of people think the only job of a caddy is to carry the bag. Well, that couldn't be more wrong. A caddy is a swing coach, a mental coach, a voice of reason and persuasion, and the person who makes sure, if you go on tilt, that things can smooth over so you can finish your round and not post some absurdly high number. Most caddies are more familiar with the course, the actual course that's being played, than the golfer. So they can say things like, hey, you know, that green is round like a basketball, so you want to land here with a little backspin, that kind of stuff. Well, Jessica Korda obviously was not thinking about all those things during her third round at the U.S. Open. According to the Golf Channel's Kelly Tilghman, the 20-year-old LPGA player fired her caddy mid-round at Sebanek Golf Club, pulling her boyfriend into the loop for the remainder of her round. Here's what she said. Johnny, grab the bag. Let's go. Well, I thought this was significant because American business for more than 70 years has seen a wholesale takeover of local banks serving the local communities by world banks, who simply act as though they are advising. But all along, they are simply extracting wealth from our professional activities for their own gain. I think it's time for us to fire them, grab a friend, and say, come on, Johnny, grab the bag and let's go. Let's get back in the game and show them what we can do. Interesting stuff. Excuse me while I take a sip of my wonderful orange juice. Ah, the stuff's so good, I'm just wondering how a glass makes it all the way through a three-hour program. Our phone lines are open, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Flight 800. A lot of people don't remember that, but it was a TWA flight that took off normally, no problems. Everything was hunky-dory. And all of a sudden, the plane exploded in midair, and everyone was lost. Well, an unreleased documentary on the 1996 TWA Flight 800 explosion offers solid proof that there was an external detonation, its co-producer said Wednesday. Of course, everyone knows about the eyewitness statements, but we also have corroborating information from the radar data. And the radar data shows an asymmetric explosion coming out of that plane. Something that didn't happen in the official theory, Tom Stalkup told CNN's New Day. A number of people have come forward, all saying the same thing, that there was an external force, not from the central wing tank. There's no evidence of that. But there is evidence of an external explosion that brought down that plane, Stalkup said. He cited corroborating information from the radar data and complained, and I know you're going to find this unbelievable, I do. He complained that not one single eyewitness was allowed to testify. That's absolutely unheard of. The documentary's producers are submitting a petition signed by many former investigators asking for the National Transportation Safety Board to reopen its investigation based on new evidence offered by the documentary, Stalkup said. The family members need to know what happened to their loved ones, he said. Asked why such information might have been suppressed, he said. That's a question that should be answered when this investigation gets reopened. The NTSB ruled that the explosion was caused by an electrical short circuit, most likely originating in the fuel gauge line, which found its way into the center wing fuel tank where it detonated fuel vapors and caused the 747, it's a Boeing aircraft, to fall in pieces into the waters off Long Island. Skeptics have long theorized that TWA Flight 800 was brought down by sinister forces. They include Hank Hughes, who served as a senior accident investigator with the NTSB and helped reconstruct the aircraft from the pieces that were recovered. Others include Bob Young, a TWA investigator who participated in the investigation, and Jim Spear, an accident investigator for the Airline Pilots Association. These investigators were not allowed to speak to the public or refute any comments made by their superiors and or NTSB and FBI officials about their work at the time of the official investigation, a news release announcing the documentary said. They waited until after retirement to reveal how the official conclusion by the NTSB was falsified and lay out their case. The documentary, TWA Flight 800, will premiere July 17th. That's a couple of weeks from now. The 17th anniversary of the crash. Stalkup is co-founder of the Flight 800 Independent Researchers Association and has been a longtime and passionate critic of the official investigation. Suspicions that criminals or terrorists were behind the TWA 800 explosion are not new. The FBI conducted a parallel investigation, but concluded that the incident was not a crime or terrorist attack. The NTSB said Tuesday that it was aware of the pending release of the documentary, which will air on Epic's TV network, and of the producer's intent to file a petition to reopen the investigation. As required by NTSB regulation, a petition for reconsideration of board findings must be based on the discovery of new evidence or on a showing that the board's findings are erroneous, NTSB spokeswoman Kelly Nantel said in a statement. At this point, the NTSB has not received a petition. However, we stand ready to review one, should one be filed. Petitions are reviewed, and a determination typically is made within 60 days. But the NTSB can take longer if necessary, she said. The Safety Board's investigation of TWA 800 lasted 4 years and remains one of the NTSB's most extensive investigations. Investigators spent an enormous amount of time reviewing, documenting, and analyzing facts and data and held a 5-day public hearing to gather additional facts before determining the probable cause of the accident, she said. But her statement leaves open the possibility the case will be reopened. While the NTSB rarely reinvestigates issues that have already been examined, our investigations are never closed, and we can review any new information not previously considered by the board, it said. The documentarians said they have a trifecta of elements. It will prove that the officially proposed fuel-air explosion did not cause the crash. That trifecta includes forensic evidence, first-hand sources, and corroborating witnesses, and the new statements from retired investigators. The evidence proves that one or more ordnance explosions outside the aircraft caused the crash, the producer said. But it does not identify or speculate on the source of the ordnance explosions. All 230 people aboard the TWA Flight 800 died when the plane headed for Paris, exploded and crashed into the Atlantic Ocean shortly after takeoff from John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York. Scores of witnesses observed a streak of light and a fireball, giving early rise to suspicions that the terrorists had struck the plane with a rocket. Now, interestingly enough, what has not been mentioned in this is that there were investigations into local boat rentals. And by boat rentals, I mean small cabin cruisers. There was a group of Middle Eastern men who had rented a cabin cruiser, took it out for one day, and it never returned. Now, a lot of people think that that boat was scuttled, that there were shoulder-fired rockets that were taken out on that boat. They waited for a plane to take off, and they shot the plane down. However, no one has ever claimed evidence for this, or claimed credit for this. And to tell you the truth, I think this plane was at about 13,500 feet when it blew up, and that's a really high altitude for a shoulder-fired rocket. They're not designed to go that high. Even a Stinger missile, shoulder-fired, will probably only go to about 5,000, 6,000 feet. By the time a 747 reaches that altitude, it's going about 350 miles an hour. This, of course, is on climb out. The wings are full of fuel. 229 passengers is about two-thirds of the capacity of a 747. No doubt it was carrying a lot of freight. When they have a light passenger load like that, they make up for it with belly freight. But having taken many transoceanic flights on a 747, I can tell you that all those tanks were awash in fuel because when these things fly, a 747, I believe that was a 747-200, they can fly at about 550 miles an hour full speed. But when they're climbing out, of course, they don't fly that fast. They climb out at about 350 to 400 miles an hour. So still, that's a long shot for a shoulder-fired missile. You'd have to have something a little more sophisticated to get that high, just to give you a clue. Now, I do have a short audio. I want to play it because it's just a couple of weeks till the documentary. Let's go ahead and play this so it kind of gets your mind going on it. Here we go.
Crash as horrific as it was mysterious. TWA Flight 800 explodes in midair in 1996 off the coast of Long Island.
It blew up in the air, and then we saw two fireballs go down to the water.
All 230 on board the 747 dead. The cause, after a four-year, 17,000-page NTSB investigation, a spark from faulty wiring leading to the center fuel tank. But now, six retired members of the original investigation team are breaking their silence. In a new documentary, they are challenging the NTSB's findings and calling for the investigation to be reopened.
I was convinced that the part had been damaged by a high explosion because of the entrance hole and the exit hole.
These former investigators, whose credentials range from the NTSB, TWA, Airline Pilots Union, and forensic experts, now claim that radar and forensic evidence shows the wiring was not the cause of the crash.
What would your analysis have been?
The primary conclusion was the explosive forces came from outside the airplane, not the center fuel tank.
Would that statement have been in your analysis?
If I got the right one.
The agenda was that this is an accident, make it so.
These investigators say that the evidence they examined proves that one or more explosions outside the aircraft caused the crash. However, they don't speculate about the source of the explosions. Among the theories considered and rejected by the NTSB at the time was that a missile was responsible. The filmmakers plan to petition the NTSB to reopen the investigation. In a statement, the NTSB left that possibility open if new evidence is uncovered, saying investigators and staff spent an enormous amount of time reviewing, documenting, and analyzing facts and data. While the NTSB rarely reinvestigates issues that have already been examined, our investigations are never closed, and we can review any new information not previously considered by the board.
So there you have it. It kind of primes you and gets you ready for the documentary that's going to come out. A lot of you don't really care about TWA Flight 800, but this was really, really hot in the news. The 747 has an incredible safety record. Hundreds of thousands of flights of these aircraft and never a single mishap. Other airplanes, yes, but not the 747. It has four engines, it has huge wings, it can carry a space shuttle on top of it. It's a way, way, way over-engineered aircraft. I've flown many times on this aircraft all around the world, and I've literally had the crap beat out of this airplane in high altitudes, turbulence over the Arctic and over, you know, Japan and overseas in Nepal. And I can just tell you, this is an incredibly, incredibly tough airplane. These planes don't have these kinds of safety problems, especially in that year. The Boeing 747 was a fairly new airframe at that time, and it just didn't have these problems. We had lots and lots of witnesses say that they saw a streak go up to the airplane, explode outside the airplane, and bring it down. Now, how many times do you look up at the sky and watch a plane taking off from the airport? Well, I think we all do. I mean, when we're driving down the freeway and we see a plane taking off from the airport, it doesn't matter if it's 5,000 or 10,000 feet. We just naturally look at it. And if something is unusual, it makes an unusual sound, or you see, you know, smoke or something like that, it immediately catches your eye, especially in a busy area like that. Taking out to off out over the Atlantic. People watch it all the time. 747 is a big airplane. It's one of the biggest in the sky, and it's very hard to miss. The fact that they did not allow any eyewitnesses to testify is just unconscionable. All right. Now, I want to talk about the snowstorm. No, not that snowstorm. There's been no snowstorms across the country because it's too bloody hot. I'm talking about Edward Snowden. I'm talking about whistleblowers. You've heard the word so many times you don't even know what a whistleblower is anymore. You hear it on other radio programs. You hear it on the news all the time. I think they've just overused the term. But they're basically two kinds. There are those that regularly do investigative reporting. And trust me, there are a lot of reporters out there. And they're not all the bubble-headed bleach blondes that read the news off a little, you know, thing that's written for them by some copy editor. There are some reporters that actually do stories and write investigative pieces. And some of them kind of dig deep, okay? You can read about them, Breitbart, Drudge Report, Huffington. You get a lot of this stuff. Well, one of these individuals, I'm going to cover this individual first who is a reporter, and then I want to cover Edward Snowden, and I'm going to give you my opinion about both of them because that's why you listen to this program. I call this piece the Hastings Assassination. You need to hear my reasoning for this because it's a little unique. Coming from the automotive industry, I know stuff that most reporters don't know. Former U.S. National Coordinator for Security, Infrastructure Protection, and Counterterrorism, Richard Clark, told the Huffington Post on Monday that the fatal crash of journalist Michael Hastings' Mercedes C250 coupe last week is consistent with a car cyber attack. What the heck is a car cyber attack? Oh, I'm glad you asked that question. He goes on to say, there is reason to believe that intelligence agencies for major powers, including the United States, know how to remotely seize control of a car, Clark said. On Saturday, Infowars.com posted a video of a talk presented by Dr. Kathleen Fisher, a program manager for DARPA, an agency of the United States Department of Defense responsible for the development of new technologies. Fisher admitted that the Pentagon has researched remote controlling cars through hacking onboard computers. In 2011, Car and Driver magazine published an article substantiating the Pentagon research. Currently, there's nothing to stop anyone with malicious intent and some computer programming skills from taking command of your vehicle. Now, it doesn't mean that they can steer it, but after gaining access, a hacker could control everything else, from which song plays on the radio to whether the brakes work, writes Keith Barry, citing research conducted by the Center for Automotive Embedded Systems Security, a partnership between the University of California, San Diego, and the University of Washington. What has been revealed as a result of some research at universities is that it's relatively easy to hack your way into the control system of a car and to do such things as cause acceleration when the driver doesn't want acceleration, to throw the brakes on when the driver doesn't want the brakes on, and to even launch the airbag while it's driving, Clark told the Huffington Post. You can do some really highly destructive things now through hacking a car. And it's not that hard. It's true. The computers on a car don't have any kind of security system. You can access them with a laptop by going into the port, or with some of them, you can access it remotely. Because all this stuff that's in the car, the throttle doesn't work with the throttle cable anymore. There's no cable going up to the fuel injection system. It's all fly-by-wire. That means that you're actually pressing on a sensor, a resistor or a Hall effect sensor under the accelerator pedal. That sends an electronic signal to a throttle positioner on the fuel injection that tells the car, here's how much fuel air to give to meet the demands that are being placed upon it by the driver. Now, if you drive one of the modern cars, you go out there, put it in drive, the light turns green, and you floor it. The car will go up through the gears in the automatic transmission just as though you were shifting. That is to say, it would accelerate up to a certain RPM. The fuel will back off a little bit. The transmission will shift, and then the fuel will reapply. That's all a coordinated system that allows the car to accelerate in a smooth manner without slamming the gears of the transmission and making you lose control. It's not like the old days where you took that turbo hydromatic transmission or that torque flight and you pulled it out into low, floor it, go up to about 60 miles an hour, shift into second, and it feels like a Mack truck rear-ended you when it shifts into second, and you leave all kinds of rubber on the road. No, it's not that way anymore. All this stuff is traction control. That's all in the program. You can change those parameters by putting a different chip in your car. That chip changes the way the fuel air management works and the way the acceleration program and traction control systems work. You can buy them. They're performance chips. You can do the same thing with a laptop, and you can even do it remotely. That's right. You can access the car's brain from a distance, from another car with a little transmitter. He also put credence in the FBI's claims, despite claims to the contrary by associates of the writer, that the agency was not investigating him. He says, I believe the FBI when they say they weren't investigating him, said Clark. That was very unusual, and I'm sure they checked very carefully before they said that. Now, I'm not a conspiracy guy. In fact, I've spent most of my life knocking down conspiracy theories. But my rule has always been you don't knock down a conspiracy theory until you can prove it wrong. And in the case of Michael Hastings, what evidence is available publicly is consistent with a car cyber attack. Now, if you mix that with the fact that Michael Hastings claimed that he was the target of a FBI investigation, that his friends were being interviewed, and his friends were telling him that they were being interviewed. And if you remember, Michael Hastings was targeted and assassinated for his journalism, most notably his story resulting in the fall of General Stanley McChrystal and remarks on NSA surveillance. The establishment media continues to portray the attack on Hastings as the delusional meanderings of conspiracy theorists. Well, prior to his apparent murder, Hastings said the Obama administration had declared war on any reporters who produced any work criticizing the president or his agendas. His desire to go into hiding, to go underground is what he said, go off the radar is what he said, expressed in an email mere hours before his assassination, demonstrates the ability of the government to monitor open opponents by using a well-developed NSA surveillance grid and take executive action against investigative journalists and others who dare to stand up to the national security state. Do you think, and you just have to remember back a little bit, do you think that the Toyota Prius crashes were a sort of test for this type of assassination? Do you remember not long ago when Toyota announced that they were now the number one car maker? The Big Three had a new fourth member that was now the number one. And a short time later, Priuses started crashing at full throttle. People were calling on their phones and 911 and saying, help, my Prius is running down the road at full throttle and there's nothing I can do about it. Well, they were reporting that, you know, the cars would go to full throttle and they were unstoppable by the drivers. And, you know, the rest of us were saying, come on, man, just turn the key off. Shut the motor down. You know, put it in neutral. Stand on the brakes. A Prius doesn't have that more powerful of a motor. Well, there is technology now in equipped patrol cars whereby vehicles can be disabled by police from behind by shutting off the throttle pack. The throttle pack, as I explained, you don't have a cable between your pedal and the fuel management system. It's electronic. Well, certain patrol cars are equipped now to be able to hack into the car and shut the throttle off. That is to say, the car goes to idle, which means it diffuses the risk for loss to the public and property caused by high-speed chases. Now, I never thought about the throttle being sent a message to go to 100% from a remote position to do exactly the opposite, to kill the occupant, regardless of risk to the surrounding environment. Now, you ask me, why didn't Mr. Hastings just step on the brakes? Well, here's why. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration requires all vehicles to have electronic stability control systems that control the brakes by computer. This means that the vehicle can be kept from going out of control by an onboard computer preventing the brakes from applying and thus allegedly correcting the vehicle back into a safe mode of operation automatically. In case you step on the brakes and lose control, the ESC will right the car and allow you to regain control. Now, the NHTSA stated in its regulations final rule that about 2,800 lives would be saved annually with this brake override feature. However, that onboard computer can be hacked or fooled to prevent the brakes from applying with exactly the same remote programming tool. Now, you ask, why doesn't he just turn the ignition off then? That's because the Mercedes does not have a key switch. It uses a proximity sensor that the driver has in his pocket. He simply pushes a button on the dash to start and stop the vehicle. However, remember, the stop button is disabled unless the vehicle is in park. Once the motor is running and the car is driving, the vehicle cannot be stopped with the button. The vehicle cannot be placed into park while it is rolling. The parking pawl will not engage. This means that Hastings' car could be sent down the road into a flaming heap, and there would be nothing the driver could do. He could not even open the doors because they are locked to prevent them from opening while the vehicle is moving. His only choice would have been to undo his seatbelt, roll down the windows or open the sunroof, and to jump out onto the street, which, remember, was flashing by at over 100 miles an hour. Not much choice but to hope the airbags and a seatbelt would save his life. By the way, those devices are only effective in collisions of around 30 miles an hour. So, NSA whistleblower Russell Tice, a key source in the 2005 New York Times report that blew the lid off the Bush administration's use of warrantless wiretapping, told Peter B. Collins on Boiling Frogs Post. Here is what he reported. They went after, and I know this because I had my hands literally on the paperwork for these sort of things, they went after high-ranking military officers. They went after members of Congress, both Senate and the House, especially on the intelligence committees and on the armed services committees, and some of the and judicial. I'm just reading what's written here. This is his quote. But they went after other ones too. They went after lawyers and law firms, all kinds of heaps of lawyers and law firms. They went after judges. One of the judges is now sitting on the Supreme Court. That I had his wiretap information in my hand. Two are former FISA FISA court judges. These are the ones that decide who gets wiretapped and who doesn't. They went after State Department officials. They went after people in the executive service that were part of the White House, their own people. They went after anti-war groups. They went after U.S. international, U.S. companies that do international business, you know, business around the world. They went after U.S. banking firms and financial firms that do international business. They went after NGOs like the Red Cross, people like that that go overseas and do humanitarian work. They went after a few anti-war civil rights groups. So, you know, don't tell me that there's no abuse, because I've had this stuff in my hand and I looked at it. And in some cases, I literally was involved in the technology that was going after this stuff. And, you know, when I said to Oberman, I said, my particular thing is high tech, and you know what's going on is the other thing, which is the dragnet. The dragnet is what Mark Klein is talking about, the terrestrial dragnet. Well, my specialty is outer space. I deal with satellites and everything that goes in and out of space. I did my spying via space. So that's how I found out about this. Now, Collins asked the question. Now, Russ, the targeting of the people that you just mentioned, top military leaders, members of Congress, intelligence committee leaders, and the, oh, I'm sorry, it was the intelligence committees. Let me correct that. Not intelligence community. And then executive branch appointees. This creates the basis and the potential for massive blackmail. Tice responds, absolutely. And remember, we talked about that before. I was worried that the intelligence community now has sway over what is going on. Now, here's the big one. I haven't given you any names. This was in the summer of 2004. One of the papers that I held in my hand was to wiretap a bunch of numbers associated with a 40-something-year-old wannabe senator from Illinois. You wouldn't happen to know where that guy lives right now, would you? It's a big White House in Washington, D.C. That's who they went after, and that's the president of the United States now. Other whistleblowers say the same thing. When the former head of the NSA's digital spying program, William Binney, disclosed the fact that the U.S. was spying on everyone in the U.S. and storing the data forever, and that the U.S. was quickly becoming a totalitarian state, that the Fed tried to scare him into shutting up. FBI officers held a gun to Binney's head as he stepped naked from the shower. He watched with his wife and youngest son as the FBI ransacked their home. Later, Binney was separated from the rest of his family, and FBI officials pressured him to implicate one of the other complainants in criminal activity. During the raid, Binney attempted to report to FBI officials the crimes he had witnessed at NSA, in particular the NSA's violation of the constitutional rights of all Americans. However, the FBI wasn't interested in these disclosures. Instead, FBI officials seized Binney's private computer, which to this day has not been returned, despite the fact that he has not been charged with a crime. Other NSA whistleblowers have also been subjected to armed raids and criminal prosecution. After high-level CIA officer John Kirikou blew the whistle on illegal CIA torture, the government prosecuted him for espionage. Even the head of CIA was targeted with extra-constitutional spying and driven out of office. Indeed, Binney made it very clear that the government will use information gained from its all-pervasive spying program to frame anyone it doesn't like. Which leads to the question, why would Obama do all these things? Why would he be afraid, for example, to take the drones away from the CIA? Well, I've come to the conclusion that he's afraid. Number one, he's afraid of what happened to Martin Luther King Jr. And I know from a good friend who was there when it happened that at a small dinner with progressive supporters, after these progressive supporters were banging on Obama before the election, why don't you do the things we thought you stood for? Obama turned sharply and said, don't you remember what happened to Martin Luther King Jr.? That's a quote, and that's a very revealing quote. In his speech on March 21st, second-term Obama gave us a big clue regarding his concept of leadership, one that is marked primarily by political risk avoidance and a penchant for leading from behind. Speaking as a politician, I can promise you this. Political leaders will not take risks if the people do not demand that they do. You must create the change that you want to see. John Kennedy was willing to take huge risks in reaching out to the USSR and ending the war in Vietnam. That willingness to take risks may have gotten him assassinated, as James Douglas argues in his masterful JFK and The Unspeakable. Martin Luther King Jr. also took great risks and met the same end. There is more than just surmise that this weighs heavily on Barack Obama's mind. Last year, pressed by progressive donors at a dinner party, I'd already said that. So, the government is attacking whistleblower Edward Snowden by claiming that he was lying about the scope of the NSA spying on Americans. Do you all have any doubts now? The National Security Agency has acknowledged in a new classified briefing that it does not need court authorization to listen to domestic phone calls. Representative Gerald Nadler, a New York Democrat, disclosed this week that during a secret briefing to members of Congress, he was told that the contents of a phone call could be accessed simply based on an analysis deciding that. If the NSA wants to listen to the phone, an analyst's decision is sufficient without any other legal authorization. Nadler said he learned. I was rather startled. Not only does this disclosure shed more light on how the NSA's formidable eavesdropping apparatus works domestically, it also suggests that the Justice Department has secretly interpreted federal surveillance law to permit thousands of low-ranking analysts to eavesdrop on phone calls. The disclosure appears to confirm some of the allegations made by Edward Snowden. Earlier reports have indicated that the NSA has the ability to record nearly all domestic and international phone calls. Does that mean someone's listening to them real time? No. But in the future, if you were to do something wrong, anything, even run for office, they'll go back and grab every single phone call that you've made, and then they will scan them and look for ways to compromise you. And if they don't want you in the election, you won't be. And if they want you in the election, but there are strings attached, then they will let you know what they learned about what you said in your phone calls. They could build a case to you, posthumously if necessary. And they will tell the people who you are, what you said, and how you may be compromised by those words. Former FBI counterterrorism agent Tim Clemente told CNN last month that in national security investigations, the Bureau can access records of a previously made telephone call. All of that stuff is being captured as we speak, whether we know it or whether we like it or not. Remember that Snowden also revealed that NSA is tapping into servers of 9 big internet companies. 2 government officials have admitted that as many as 50 American companies are now feeding the NSA with real-time user data. And we've documented that the NSA gives information gained through spying to large corporations. We've already talked about that. I can tell you we're completely out of time right now, but I can tell you right now that if it becomes expedient to compromise you, it will be done. And they're not just listening to your phone calls and my phone calls. They're listening to our lawmakers' phone calls as well. Every tweet, every email, every phone call. They're under surveillance, and anything that's in there that can compromise them will bring them into their employ, as it were. Now, as I said, I have 54 pages of notes tonight. I barely made it through 30 pages. If you want a copy of it, email me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. I will be happy, very happy, to send you a copy of it. That's all we have tonight for X Squared Radio. I'm Brooks Agnew. We'll see you next week right here on the BBS Radio Network. Good night.
X Squared Radio.